But the last thing we saw in the Rambam, in this section which deals with the laws of tshuva, which for those who knew means the general subject of trying to feel out and correct the spiritual balance that a person has within him, correct things you did wrong, make up for deficiencies that you left, things uncompleted. The last thing we saw is this, that anybody who does a mitzvah and then regrets it, negates the mitzvah completely. Like we said, just like you can do something wrong, and you could regret that thing that you did wrong correctly, that would have the effect of wiping it out completely if you did it with all the requirements as we saw before. Similarly, the opposite force exists in the spiritual world, that if you did something right and regretted it deeply enough, then you would wipe out that thing that you did. Alright, next thing Rambam says is this, that if a person really does wipe out something that he did in the past, either way around, the main subject he means here is if he wipes out things that were negative, then it's never mentioned to you again. It means that even when a person stands in judgment, that thing is completely negated. And he never has to face that thing again. That means if you face it now, and you generate the energy that wipes that thing out of your personality, then there's nothing they ever have to judge you for, because you've done the work of wiping it out. If you don't do that, then the concept we have of judgment is the concept that a person has to come face to face with the things that they did that were damaging, and the pain of having to face that thing and not being able to do anything about it, that's what actually wipes it out of your consciousness. But it's done by pain. You can do the same energy through what's called tshuva, which isn't necessarily painful. It always involves a certain amount of pain, because the regret, the real understanding of what it was that you did, is painful. But it's not the same kind of pain. The other kind of pain is what we call the pain of punishment. It's not punishment in the sense of, like the legal system punishes criminals. It doesn't mean that. The punishment means simply the very fact of facing up to it and suffering the pain of realizing what it was that you did. But that pain, when it's felt deeply enough, that itself will correct the thing that was wrong. Except, although they both correct the mistake equally efficiently, but one is much, much more painful. And we've mentioned stories in the Gemara before about people who voluntarily took on sufferings in this world, the most intense suffering, rather on just the off chance that they have to undergo some suffering in the next world, because apparently that suffering is indescribable. That could be much, much worse over there. Much better to take care of it over here. That's what he says. Then he says, "Ukashem sheshoklin schuyos." Please feel free to ask questions if something isn't clear. Sunday night you're supposed to ask questions. And just like a person at the moment of his death is weighed up in terms of the positivity that he generated and the negativity, so every year each individual has everything that he's done weighed up. Kol Baya Olam. Kol Baya Olam means Jews and non-Jews. It doesn't only mean Jews. That's a special, he makes it very clear here. Everybody's judged. On Rosh Hashanah, everybody is judged. I'm not going to go into the next two paragraphs in detail, because here he deals very much in detail with Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur and how it works. And when we get to that time of year, we'll be able to see that in more detail. But the things to note at this point are as follows. First of all, that there's a judgment when a person dies. That needs to be understood. And secondly, there's a judgment every year. The things that are difficult are, we've discussed some of these things before, that it says in the mystical sources that every year there's a judgment even of people who've died already. Right? We've explained that before. Let's mention it again. So it comes out like this. A person's judged every year. Actually, he's judged all the time. But there's a special focus of judgment every year. Then, at the end of a person's life, he's judged again. Then, after a person's no longer in this world, when the neshama's in that intermediate world, which is called Olam HaNeshamas, in that world, there is a judgment every year also. Let's understand what that means. And then there's a final judgment that's going to take place at the final stage of what we understand to be this phase of the world's history, or this phase plus the next one, which is the messianic phase. So very briefly, we understand the following thing. First of all, judgment all the time means, again, it doesn't mean judgment that there's a courtroom and prosecutors and so forth. It means that, it does mean that. It means that also. If you read all the mystical writings, they say clearly that that's the way it happens. But a person has to understand what that means. if he pictures it in childish terms, like that, it isn't like that. But in the depth, it's exactly the same as that. Well, it's not so easy to understand. The root of the idea is that judgment means that you simply are brought face to face with who you are. That's it. That's the ultimate form of judgment. That nobody's speaking against you. The thing that speaks against you are your own negative actions. It says that you face... I'm trying to understand this. It says that you face a courtroom. Right? This is every year. This is at the end of a person's life. This is how it will be at the end. It says quite clearly that the mystical axiom that operates here is that the way judgment functions in this world is the way it functions in the higher world. That's part of a bigger principle that we have touched on before, that everything in this world operates the same way as in the spiritual world, and it has to be that way, because this world only looks the way it does because its genes in the spiritual world are that way. Right? But that doesn't only apply to objects like a human body. We know that the human body is shaped the way it is because in the spiritual world, the forces are set up in that way. There's a thing called the right hand in the spiritual world. It doesn't look like a right hand. It looks much more like a right hand than yours does. But that's the root of the thing. So in the physical world, it crystallizes into a thing that looks like this. But it corresponds exactly. But not only does it, and the left hand also, and so forth, all parts of the body function that way. But not only parts of the body, even functions of the body, or emotions of the mind, are also only crystallized versions in this world of what they are in essence in the spiritual world. And of course the spiritual world is a reflection of a higher world and so forth, right, until a level where we're not even allowed to talk about it. But that's the general principle. But it isn't only that the body looks that way and the functions look that way, but even the abstract things that happen in this world are based on the same idea. For example, time. The way time operates here is that every instant of time in this world is a very complicated subject, just to get the basic pattern. The way time operates in this world is that a moment of what we call time, which is the most abstract of all existence, right? The most practical and real and the most abstract. That's why the mystics call it the ultimate female dimension is time. Time is that which holds all the other physical dimensions within it. The physical world is also female, and it's always referred to in the female because it's the vessel that gives birth to everything that happens. But time is the vessel that holds the whole physical world. Now, we're not going to go into this in detail now. But the way time happens is that it's a manifestation of changes in the spiritual world. I said you could ask questions on Sunday night, but not now, okay? Not on this. I don't know how to answer them. I'm just telling you the words. What they mean, I don't know. It's not possible to know this beyond a certain level. Is that the spiritual world, which is not subject to change, undergoes change. Certain level of the spiritual world, which we define as being an intense oneness that can't undergo change, nevertheless it generates change. Actually, the way we understand it, if this helps, I don't think it helps much, but I'll tell you, it doesn't really undergo change, it just undergoes the potential of change. What that looks like in a world where change is possible is that change happens. You're not going to come next week, right? For those who are interested in that level, that's what it means. But the point is this, that as change occurs in the spiritual world, what happens is each flicker of a change there manifests as a new moment of time here. What is the change that occurs? Different permutations of Hashem's name come into focus. Are you with me? The letters of Hashem's name, the four letters of His name, and each of them has four, and each of them has four. Actually, it's not four, it's five, and it's not five, it's ten. But anyway, the way it is there, the way it is up there, as they go through the permutations which spell out the names that they have to spell, each new permutation forms a second of time here. It's what the mystics call the Tatrap Rigay Shah, the 1,080 instants that make up an hour in this world. Okay, be that as it may, we'll talk about that some other time. But that's the mystical concept we have. There's some mystical dimension. And what it means is that Hashem in His essence is generating a manifestation of His own being. A name means, not so difficult if you think about it, a name means what I have of you. I never can experience you directly, but the way you manifest to me is your name. Is that right? When I have your name, a very abstract version of you, you may be far away. But if I have your name, I have the right address, and you'll respond to that name if I call it. That means a very, very direct link to you. Even a deeper link than it would be holding on to your clothing or something that's attached to you. Could be even deeper than holding on to your hand. A name is. And we have Hashem's name. That means, okay? That means that we have a link into what His essence is. And the way His name manifests, that's what appears in this world. Be that as it may. But each manifestation of His name gives rise to a moment of time in this world. Actually gives rise to everything in this world. Now. So we understand like this. Not only the body manifests that way and every blade of grass, but even the events that happen in the world like time. But even deeper than that, the whole structure of human existence reflects the spiritual world. Which means that if human beings are enjoined to set up a court system that judges the way we have to judge here according to Torah law, it's only because in the spiritual world they judge that way. And it's judged exactly the same way as it is here. There is a judge, there's a prosecutor, there's a defense attorney, there's you in the dock. The procedure is exactly the same way. Charges are brought, you've got a chance to answer the charges. If you can prove that the charges are not valid, they don't begin the court case. There's a whole series of events that happens in the spiritual. The only way we can understand it, of course, is by translating into what it looks like in a human court. And by the way, if you've ever been in one, ever been in a human court, even for a silly offense, but feel terrible. Feel terrible. You have to get the idea. I wouldn't suggest you go to court just to get an idea of what it is, but if you ever have to, you'll realize that it's an awesome experience. I once had to go to court. What can I tell you? I once, after 2 years in Israel, I still hadn't paid my car license thing. I didn't understand what the thing was talking about. They sent me these pieces of paper. I didn't know what you had to do with it, so eventually they sent me a thing saying that I couldn't pay any fines, I had to appear in court. And I didn't understand the system, and my Hebrew wasn't that good yet. And I arrive in court, and there, it's terrible, terrible. Especially being religious, the whole system is stacked against you. So, but you understand that you learn a lot about Hashgacha, because the judge turned out to be, the judge said to me, "Where are you from?" So I said, "From Saudi." He said, "Really, where are you from?" So I said, "Yovel." He said, "Really, I lived there for 20 years, you know, this one, and this one, and this one, and this one." And eventually he said, "Well, nice knowing you, goodbye." So the prosecutor said to him, "Hey, what are you doing?" The prosecutor said to him, "What's going on?" The policeman said, "You can't let him go. What's going on? He hasn't paid his license for 2 years. We've got to jail him. We've got to do something about it." The judge said, "No, forget about it." But he says, "No, you can't do that." You know? So I was saying, "No, you can. You can." So eventually he decided, it's very interesting. The judge turned out to be, I saw afterwards, he was a religious man. And he fined me the amount of money, it's remarkable. He fined me the exact amount that the license fees would have cost me. Right? No more. Why? He said to me, "Shelo yehei chet niske." It's a principle in the Gemara that a person shouldn't benefit through having done a sin. So he said, I should not, you follow me. Although he understood that I was to be let off because I didn't understand what was going on, and he considered that was justification for my not having paid my license fees, but he felt that that didn't justify my getting away without having paid the license fees. So he fined me exactly the amount it would have cost me. It's remarkable. That's actually the way it works in the spiritual world. But I wouldn't rely on getting such a judgment, usually. Of course, in that case, it was completely fair. It was exactly right. So that's but anyway, so you understand what it is when you have to go to court, even for a silly thing. Imagine how it feels when you've really done something wrong. And the punishment's really enormous. And you know. So in the spiritual world, it says that it's set up that way. The only thing is to understand that as you hear the scenario, you have to keep translating the elements into what they really are. Here in this world, it's a prosecutor. In that world, the one who prosecutes you is your own negative actions. You see, when we try and explain it to each other, or to children, or to the child in us, we explain that it means that you're standing in the dock, and Hashem is present in some way. His presence manifests in the courtroom. Sometimes it does, sometimes it doesn't. Sometimes he leaves it to elements in his system, which is much worse. If you can get it hearing by him, that's much, much better. That's a whole mystical subject also. Talk about it maybe a bit later. But what happens is the system set up. Then what happens is those who have good to say about you come forward and they say, right, they bring out all the positivity in that particular action or extenuating circumstances or whatever it is, and then all the negative forces come and speak bad about you. Who are those forces? Who's that prosecutor? He is the... Well, let's put it in mystical terms. He's the spiritual force that you generated when you did the action. The Rambam is talking about judgment now, so let's try and understand a few principles about spiritual judgment, okay? You with me? You'll see the most incredible things come out of this. Unbelievable. I'm going to tell you something tonight that if you haven't heard it before, you're going to sail out of here, okay? Despite the fact how frightening this is, you're going to be the happiest person in the world if you understand this thing correctly, because I'm going to show you a way of how to block all judgment against you. No matter what you've done, okay? Even before tshuva, you can block all... You can be absolutely sure that they can't touch you. I'll show you that. If you pay me. If you pay me a lot of money.
Okay. I run a stutter fund. This information is worth a lot of money. Okay. So I'll get to that in a moment. But it works like this. The people, the agencies that speak against you are the forces you generated. If you want to put it into English, unfortunately it perverts it, but it's called an angel. Right? But that destroys the whole concept. There's no child over there with wings on his back fluttering around in the courtroom that's got things to say about you. It's a malach, means an emanation of divine essence. And that emanation you created. Right? It says that every time you do something in the world, every action of yours creates a spiritual force, creates this malach, creates this agency, and he flies around in the world, right? Which means he exists in the essence of the world, doing what you gave him power to do. Now, every action of yours, if you want to understand it in the lowest terms, let's say you were brought up in the Western world, and you're not so comfortable talking about malachim, so then you could understand it in its lowest version like this, that every time you do an action, it ripples around in the world, having consequences according to what that action was. Are you with me? If you say a kind word to someone, a real mitzvah type activity, let's say you say a kind word to a friend or a work associate or somebody who needs a kind word at a moment when the person really needs it and a moment when it was hard for you to give it. You were in a rush under your own stress and you managed to hold yourself up and realize another person's need and you managed to manifest kindness at that time. What will happen then is that many, many things will happen. Actually, the way you think about it is wrong. You think that you feel good and then you forget about it. But actually what happens is the spiritual world doesn't forget about it. Because that person's life is changed because of that thing. Changed in many, many ways. First of all, that person might have been on his way out to commit suicide. Not in a dramatic extreme. But even if he wasn't, he might have been about to do something that would ruin one of his own intimate relationships. He might have done something that even not that dramatic, but he would have said a word to one of his children that would have maybe something they would remember for the rest of their lives as bitter. Or formulate them in a certain way. Every word counts. Now because you've done what you did, so you change that person's outlook, you change his whole day. He's going to manifest a different outlook, even if it's only a millionth of a millionth of a millionth of a percent difference than he would have been. And often it's much, much more than that. Especially if it was a real act of effort and the person really appreciated that. So you understand, the consequences are enormous. That person's day is changed. His whole mental attitude is changed. He'll cope better with the problem that he had. And maybe his whole future will be different because of that. He'll love you in a way that he didn't love you before. So a whole relationship of warmth will be set up between you. Many years later, that may come back to save your life. There's many, many things that are going to ripple out into the world. Not only that, but you trained yourself to be more sensitive now. That act that you did when it was tough for you made you into a person who's able to be more sensitive. So in the next tight spot you get into, you're going to respond differently than had you not exercised the self-control back then. You follow? We could go on and on and on all night about it. The ripples that go out of the smallest action are infinite, especially but not a small action. That positivity that you vibrated out ripples around in the spiritual world. If you want to look at it technically, it actually ripples around in the physical world. And it actually has consequences. And sometimes you actually zecher to see the consequences. Somebody will tell you years later something you never even thought of or remembered. You might have been not even realized you did something. Somebody years later, that often happens to you. They'll tell you that you don't know it, but you did this and this, and this is what happened, and amazing, amazing things might have happened. Right? Because you made that small effort. And of course, negatively, the same thing. That energy that's put out into the spiritual world, we could call it a malach. Again, there's much, much higher versions of this spiritual force that manifest in the cosmic structure. But you could look at it this way also. When you end up in the courtroom, which happens every day, every year, at the end of your life, etc., what happens is, in essence, it's very hard to say the words, but in essence what happens is, you're simply exposed to your own naked self. That's all. There's no courtroom. Doesn't picture the scene in childhood terms. Actually, what happens is you're stripped of all the smokescreen physicality camouflage that you take refuge behind all the time while you're alive. It just isn't there anymore. And what happens is you experience your own raw naked being. So the positivity that you've generated, that is you. What else is you? The body isn't there. Let's face it, what else is there? Now, let's be logical about it. Either there is no world after this, or there is. If there isn't, I don't know what you're doing here. If there isn't, let's forget about the whole subject. You might as well close your eyes now, I won't be offended. Go to sleep, it's okay. Now, if you're really convinced about that. If there is a spiritual world, then what is it? The body, it isn't. Now, that's for sure. That's one thing we know remains here. The body remains here. So what is it? It's what you are inside. Now, in the mystical writings, it tells us that what you are inside minus what you were born with. Because nobody's interested in that. You follow me? And this world is exactly the opposite. In this world, you get credit for your talents. People compliment you in this world on being good looking, let's say. Right? You should be embarrassed if that happens to you. And people take pride in it. You know, have you noticed? It's a terrible thing. They take a little child and they praise the child on being good looking, and the child is taught to relate to it as if he did something. But he didn't do anything. Praise is not fitting for a thing that you were born with. Or if they praise a child for being clever, they tell a child how clever he is. That's a foolish, destructive thing to do to a child. Because that's not a thing that you deserve praise for. You're born that way. The question is, what have you done with it? Are you with me? So in the next world, they don't look at the things that you were born with. Those things fall away. That was the raw material you were given to get on with life, just like your body. The question is, what did you do with all that? That you deserve praise for. If you took good looks and you used it for something dynamic, or you took bad looks and you used it to cope with the world, well, right? And it's better not to be good looking, by the way, especially if you're a woman. Despite what the world tells you. I know you never would believe me, but I'm going to show you. Why? The more gifted you are in the physical world, the more you tend to lean on those gifts and not work on the pneumius. You don't work on the internality. So, you follow me? It's much harder to work on yourself inwardly when you're able to coast along, everybody liking you and relating positively to you because you have the outward characteristics that they relate to easily. But it doesn't make you do any inner work. Actually, if you really want to know... Oh, too sidetracked. If you really want to know, every woman has a very, very intense beauty. Every woman, right, has a very, very intense beauty. But that beauty is an inner beauty. It's only reflected by the outward body. What a woman has to work on is to bring out the inner chayin, what's called chayin. She has to bring out that glow. If a woman knows how to do that, it doesn't matter what she looks like externally, she can be very, very attractive. You know, we're coming up to Purim now. It says that Esther was peculiar looking. Do you know that? It says she was actually greenish. Which means that she had a physical appearance that was abnormal, but she had such a chut shel chesed, it means like a thread of chayin that was held over her, that everybody loved her. Nobody could resist her. Every nation on earth claimed she was one of them. Whatever nation saw her, they said like she had everyone, she was there, she looked like she came from there, and no one knew she was Jewish. They all thought she was one of theirs. She had such an incredible inner beauty. You follow me? What happens to women is, you see, again, we live in such a terrible society, a society that batters the external dimension so powerfully that they take, if you don't look like the kind of thing that they pin up on the mechanics in the garage, you know, with the... If you don't look like that, then not only don't they look, they make you feel like inadequate, like there's something wrong with you. They make you feel like this, you don't think. And then what happens is your own inner chayin gets squashed. You don't have the confidence to exude that beauty into the world, the beauty of a woman's modesty, which is a hidden beauty. That glow doesn't come out. And so what happens is you actually start to look ugly. And people perceive it. This applies to men 100%. Men just use it worse when they're good looking than women do. That's all. They take advantage more. But women tend to put less effort into things when they... It says in the next world, your biggest disadvantage, your biggest handicap will be your greatest pride. Because that's what made you who you were. You worked against that. Of course, we don't look for disadvantages. We look to have advantages and to use them very, very well. But you're much more responsible to use your gifts and advantages than you are for your negativity. If you just cope with what your problems were in life, that's accounted to you as if you succeeded. But if you took your gifts in life and didn't make incredible mileage out of them, you're very sharply punished and held against you because that's where that's where your talents were. You had no right not to use those talents for positivity. This is a whole subject. The reason I focused on women is because we're coming up to Purim, and the special beauty of a Jewish woman is that which physically remains hidden. The Jewish woman radiates her beauty by hiding her physical beauty. It's by taking care to hide the physicality that she radiates an inner being. You follow? What happens to a Jewish woman is as soon as she radiates the body, then the male world takes note of the body, and what happens is they don't relate to the inner being. And then the woman doesn't bring out the inner being because she doesn't need to bring it out. And so the whole world becomes superficial just like horses. That's what happens. Well, the way a woman radiates spirituality into the world is by taking such care to tone down what looks like a horse that the inner being can radiate out. That's one of the reasons, I'm not going into marriage and all that now, but that is one of the reasons why before marriage we have no physical contact. In a Jewish marriage system, we don't allow any physical contact between boy and girl before marriage, because then what happens is he has to relate to her as a human, has to relate to the depth of who she is. If you allow the physical relationship to develop before marriage, then immediately that's where the electricity is, and that's what takes it. There's no demand for anything else to So that's why any woman that understands what she is in the world would very much limit, right? She'd be very, very religious in that way, because that's what will bring out that a man would really relate to her as what she wants to be related to, right? In the depth that she... Anyway, that's another subject. Now. What happens is this. When you're stripped of all that, right? Of all the gifts that you were born with, of all the physicality, when all that falls away, the only thing that's left is what's become of you. What you made of yourself. That's all. You have to understand this, because it's a very frightening idea. If you coast through life doing well with your gifts, and you happen to be talented in certain areas, so you use that for your human relationships, you use it to make a living, you use it to basically cope in life, what will happen is, when you end up, you'll be absolutely nothing. You'll be a zero. You'll be a blank. You'll be a blank space. Because you never used them. You never worked on them. You only put here to develop what you are. So if you just took the gifts and never worked on them, the gifts fall away. You with me? Just like the body. The body's going to be a big blank over there, isn't there? The only thing that remains... I mean, that's an obvious idea. We've spoken about it before. Now, that percentage increase, what you worked on, generates a positivity. Part of it is you, part of it is the world, part of it is the positivity that rippled out into everyone around you, and we call that force in its root dimension, we call it a malach. But the point is, so what all I'm trying to illustrate is this, that it's very difficult to say all these words. You follow? It's going to take hours and hours to explain what it is that you face in the next world. It's much easier to speak in allegory, which is the way the mystics always speak. They say that you end up in a courtroom, and what faces you is a malach. The malach was born out of the deeds that you did. That's easy, you can say it in a few sentences. The trouble is it's misleading if you don't have spiritual sensitivity, because you grow up thinking like a child. You think, are you with me? Is the idea clear? Alright, so I'm going to speak now in the analogy. Are you acceptable? I can't keep speaking out each idea in what it means spiritually. It's going to take hours. Are you with me? But you've got to do the translation. So you stand in a court. The court is, again, I remind you, it's just you facing yourself. That's all it is. There's no court, there's no debate, there's no nothing. You just suddenly realize who you are. And the happiness of what you've achieved is intense happiness, because you built it. And the pain of what you didn't do that you should have done is intense, because it's you. You hacked out your own spiritual organs, and you can't bring them back now. You follow? But again, in the analogy, what happens is that there is a courtroom, and you stand there. And there's a judge. And then march in all these prakliten, they call it, these the agencies for the defense, whatever it is called, right? No, the defense, the agents, the defense, right? These deeds that you generated, the positivity, they all come and testify, maybe witnesses, they testify, right, that you did this and this and this and this and this. But of course, the other side, they also march in and testify against you. The good news is that everything you ever suffered, I told you this story, didn't I? Huh? You better hear it again for those who haven't heard it. Huh? I'll leave it till the end, okay? We'll end with that. Remind me then, right? Okay. Now, I want to develop this idea. Remind me at the end, okay? Blinere, I'll tell you at the end a story that if you're still terrified at the end, the story will help you. But anyway, there are exceptions, but the general idea is that those agencies speak about you. What you did negative, the time you hurt this person, the time you hurt that person, the time you slackened in your what you should have been working on and so forth, they all speak up. They speak up, and you have to face them. And you're given a chance to answer. Of course, there's no answering. They know what's going on up there. But it means that all extenuating circumstances also come out. And you're able. Actually, if you really want to know, nobody speaks, only you speak. It says in the deeper... all the deeper sources, that a book is open, then you write your own story. Nobody else writes. And because what happens is, as you try not to, you're forced into it. Because, for example, when they show you that you did a certain negative thing, the natural inclination will be you'll try and justify it. You'll try and explain that you did it because of this and this and this. But then they'll show you by your very words that isn't a valid excuse. You follow? I mean, the classic example would be, as we said before, the Balei Musa always mention it, they show you that, let's say you slackened in your mitzvah activity, right? You didn't put energy into working on yourself, helping people, etc. So then you'll say, well, look, it's not my fault. I've got a natural trail of laziness. That's what you'll say. I find it very hard to get up and go. Some people have got a lot of energy. They get up and go. I find it very hard to get motivated. They say, is that so? Then they turn the page and they show you where you got up at 5 in the morning to go jogging or I don't know, whatever it is, or for your business activities where you had plenty of energy, or chasing women, or I don't know, whatever it is that you had energy for. They show you all that, but there's nothing you can say about that. You follow? Because it means where you wanted to, you had the energy. Where you didn't, you didn't. But your own admission, you follow, it's the own words that you said that get you into a mess. Nobody there speaks anything. So what happens is that your whole essence comes out over there. Right? Now, and of course the good essence comes out too. And the Rambam's going to explain to us, that's an incredibly fair system, on the next page, if we ever get there. On the next page, the Rambam's going to explain that actually they hold against you your negative deeds only after they've given the positive deeds a chance to outweigh them. The Rambam will say on the next page that they take your first positive deed, they take your first negative deed and they knock it out. The second, they knock it out. Only from the third one on do they start counting. That means they give you an advantage of three actions, three deeds of positivity before they start counting negativity. And if it's a Jewish community, four. Not an individual. He'll explain later how that works. That you get a credit balance before you start. They give you a credit balance, right, before they start knocking off one against another. That's a very interesting how it works on Rosh Hashanah. But I'm not going into that now. But the point is that's how this process works. Now. But I'm very hesitant to go into the next stage because it's terribly easy to see it in the childhood terms and miss the point, okay? To promise me you'll try to keep translating it into the essence level. So it says like this, that when the court is arraigned, when everything, the trial, when everything, so then what happens is the court is set up against you in the same stage as that a human court is set up here. It has to be that way. That's what happens. What happens? First of all, you're summoned. Right? First of all, you're summoned. Then there's actually eight stages. There are eight stages that the court goes through before there's a prosecution. First you're summoned, then you come to court, then they read out the charges. At each stage you have a chance to defend yourself or to make a plea in one way or another. Then finally you get to speak in your own defense. And then the prosecutor speaks against you, and then you get a chance to answer the charges, and then finally the judgment is made, and finally a verdict is handed down, and just after that a punishment if you're guilty. If you're not acquitted, then a sentence is handed down. All those stages, might have left out one or two, but that's what it is. Now at each stage of the proceedings you have a possibility to block the proceedings at that stage. I'm just going to single out one of them because it's incredibly important, especially in this difficult time that the Jewish people we find ourselves in. As I mentioned before, there's one particular avenue that a person can use that can block, that could save the Jewish people. There's one trick that, if you know it, so this is the thing I was going to tell you, that can absolutely save your life and the life of the Jewish people. So I'll choose that one, right, to illustrate. But the point is that each stage, if you know how to go about it, for example, when they summons you, so you can block the proceedings at that stage by never having done anything wrong. That's always the best. Once they got your name on the files, it's like the army, you know. Once they got your name on the books, a computer might do anything. You don't know what's going to happen. Up there, the computer doesn't just do anything. But it's not good to have your name on the books there. So the first thing is not to have your name come up at all. If you're already too late for that, so you do tshuva right now. Before they start calling your name in courtrooms and sending out summonses and all that stuff, it's bad news to have a record against you of that kind of thing. So that's the first place. Do nothing wrong. And if you've done something wrong, do tshuva before the clerk of the court gets your name on his list and he gets time to think. The second stage you can do, you can apply for deferment of the trial. You can apply for deferment. You have to explain to them that when your name comes up and the trial's about to begin, of course it might be any moment. So in your tefillah tonight, before you go to sleep, you should do this. Hashem, listen, I know that you've got a lot of messengers up there and you're sending out the agents and all that. There's a few things I haven't done to you before, but I'm applying for deferment of the trial because I really would like to take care of certain things. It is not fair to try me right now. You have to make a very good... You've got to really convince him, right? Which means, convince him means you've got to change you. You can't change his mind, but you've got to change you. But if you genuinely generate the desire, you know, that's what Hashem's doing with us now. Why this whole mess is dragging out so long? Because he wants us to be doing something about it. If he wanted to give us a really hard time, he could have done it, chas v'shalom, in the first day without any warning. The reason he made it drag out so long for days and days and days with a date announced, and the first day was the day of tshuva, because Yom Kippur cotton, and then he carries on and he bombs empty buildings. You know the Nisim got happening in Eretz Yisrael. I just got a tape from my nephew who told me that he went to Tel Aviv to see the things that are going on there, the unbelievable things going on. A building in Tel Aviv collapsed, four stories of a building collapsed. No one in all four stories was hurt, including a man on the thing. When they finally dug him out, wanted to take him to hospital, he said no reason, he brushed off the dust. They went home. Four stories of a building collapsed, not one person in the building was hurt, hit directly. You know, my aunt's house was damaged in Savion by the fact that a neighbor's house was wiped out on two separate occasions. On the one occasion, the neighbor's house was wiped out, the people were in Jerusalem, On the next occasion, another family, they were in the house, and none of them were hurt at all. A direct hit by tons of explosive, whatever the stuff is. I mean, I know of somebody whose baby was in this tent thing, and the wall collapsed on the baby. The house was hit. The wall collapsed on the baby. The baby's tent was shredded. This thing they put the child in, this whole piece of equipment, was absolutely shredded, and the baby was gurgling with glee. Nothing wrong with the baby. I mean, amazing things that are happening. Why is he doing all this to us? No, he wants some kind of response from us. So what you're supposed to say, you say, Hashem, listen, I got the message. What happened? And I figured it out. So I went to some shira on a Sunday night, and there was this character who was talking about this kind of thing, and it made sense to me. So I want you to do is just do me a favor. Give me a couple of days deferment of the trial. I know I can't put it off anymore, but I can defer it. And that's a very clever thing to do. Because meantime, while they're busy deferring the trial and they're hearing other people's trials, you run around, give back the money, and you make good all the things that you shouldn't have with you, and you apologize to all the people. And when you come to trial, look, Hashem gave tshuva. You know, nothing you can't try, you put things that you've undone. You follow me? There's a whole sequence you can do. Okay, you can plead mitigation. There's a whole thing. It pays to take a legal course or employ a lawyer to explain. It doesn't have to be religious. Just get a good lawyer to explain to you how it works here. Then you know exactly how to do it over there. And there's many things you can do. You can plead at the end, right? If they do sentence you, you can plead for mitigation of sentence. You can plead that they're extenuating circumstances. You can plead that you don't deserve such a difficult sentence because there are other people who depend on you, maybe. And what you should do while they're busy sentencing you is make yourself indispensable to as many people as possible. You follow? So that Hashem needs you around in the world. If you're an independent type of soul, it doesn't make any difference to the world, so it doesn't mess up his plans too much if you're here or not here, chas v'sholom. But if you support a lot of families, right, and you do a lot of chesed in the world, a lot of people need you, so you become part of Hashem's system. And it says that he takes all that into account. He might put up with you in the world for another few years, even though he actually wouldn't normally, because it's much easier for him to do that because of what you're doing for him, rather than make a whole new system to deal with all those things. It says that. That's why there are many people who do many things in the world to make themselves indispensable to many people, in the hope that Hashem, Father, there's many things you can do. You can also plead for deferment of execution of the sentence. You can plead that you understand you deserve the sentence, but I wouldn't mind giving it to you just a little bit later. And then, of course, in that time, you can sneak in, and there's a lot of things you can do. But the one thing I want to just... bargaining. He sets it up in such a way that you can bargain, but it has to be a valid bargaining. Why not? Absolutely not. He put you here to do a certain job. As he's about to squeeze you for not doing the job, if you bargain with him and say, listen, I realize what's about to happen, but I'll make a deal with you. Give me another chance and I'll do the job. So why wouldn't he let you do the job? He's not out to get you for no reason. You follow? The way it works is like a company that sent an agent out to make a few sales, and the chap spent all his expense account on living at the Hilton and eating caviar. So when the company finally traces him, and they've spent all this money on him, so the one thing they might do is fire him. But if he's an intelligent salesman, he'll tell them, like, for the extra expense of another couple of days, he'll sober up and he'll try and make a few deals, so they might let him try. And if he brings home the goods, they'll be happy with him. What's the problem? They just care about the income. Right? That's how it works, believe me. Okay? But I'll tell you, if you find that hard to accept, boy, the next thing's going to blow you away. Okay? But there's one element of this process that's absolutely mind-boggling. A lot of people are aware of it now because there's been a large awareness of this. Somebody giving shirim overseas, some tapes were sent out, but it's quite right. And the thing to understand is this. Listen carefully now. This is the most fascinating, incredible part of the system of judgment. And it's like this. The judgment works against you, the whole process works against you only by agencies that you've generated. You generate the courtroom, you generate the trial, the date of the trial, how they speak against you, how they speak for you, write the sentence. Obviously you generate it all. It's not arbitrary. It's all exactly fitting according to what you did. But it works according to an incredible principle in the spiritual world, which is called Midah Keneged Midah. Midah Keneged Midah means one measure against another measure. Exact balance of one measure against another. Which means the following idea. That the only thing that can happen in the spiritual world is exactly the way you did it here. Which should be obvious after what we've discussed. Which means that none of the procedures can happen unless you gave them power. Now, when you work that out, you'll see if you go through the whole process, you'll see you can use it at each stage of the judgment, and you should be working on it like crazy, especially Rosh Hashanah time, but at all times, you should be working on it very, very hard at all levels. But there's one incredible level which is absolutely amazing, and it's as follows. When it comes to the stage, let's say you couldn't avoid the trial, and you couldn't get it deferred, and you've come to trial, and you're guilty. You've got certain things, right, that you haven't done tshuva for, and the trial's in progress. Let's say you've got that far, which is terrible. And a prosecutor walks in. He's a terrible, terrible being. He's a very, very ugly being, right? This prosecutor, this malach, this spiritual emanation. He's a very, 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 very fearsome creature. Right? He's you, actually. He's all the negativity, the worst of your own being. That's what he is. He's vicious as you can imagine. He is every bit as vicious as you could be. Because he is you. You follow? The awesome thing to face, your own black self. Your own negative image. That's what it is. He walks in and is about to rattle off a list of the most awesome and hideous things that you've done. And they're all going to hear about it. And it's going to be absolute justice, no question about it. At that stage, there's a trick, a card you have up your sleeve, which is as follows. And maybe we'll continue next week. And that's as follows. What makes him speak against you? What makes him able to speak? Only you're speaking. Because every detail that happens in the courtroom happens by the power you gave it. Nobody can prosecute you unless you gave power to prosecution in whatever you did in this world. You were accusatory against somebody else. Then you follow. If you only showed chesed to other people and you never held other people up for what you could have, let's say people owed you things and you could have taken advantage and you never did, they can't bring you to trial. They can't bring you to trial because the midah that brings you to justice is only given power by your bringing people to justice. You follow me? So if you were able to bring somebody to justice against you, and you could have done it, and you didn't, what happens is they can't bring the charges against you. Because, not that they don't or they can't, but the only force that brings that into the world is where you did that in the world. Are you following me? So if you did that, if you never put that force out into the world, they just can't do it to you. Now, what makes, you follow? Now, what makes him start speaking? He's got this long list of things, and he's going to start in front of the court, in front of Hashem, or Hashem's emissaries. Unfortunately, it's usually not Hashem himself. It will be Hashem himself that overrides all of us. And Hashem himself operates against you with rachamim, which means he gives you tremendous, tremendous kindness. But if you get into the courtroom, he leaves it to the court. He sets up a system that's much, much harsher. It's called din. Instead of rachamim that he does himself, he leaves it over to the agencies that you set up, if you deserve that. Which is much, much, much worse. It's better to throw yourself on Hashem's kindness than let the system that you generated take care of you, because as cruel as you are. But let's say you got into that system, right? And now it's too late and he's about to speak. So listen carefully. The only way he can speak against you is by the speaking that you've done in the world. Because the power comes only from where you put it in. And the only power that he has to speak against you is where you've spoken against anybody else. If you ever said Lashon Hara or Achilles, if you've got the Aveira of Lashon Hara in your hand, so then you follow, you know what Lashon Hara is? To say anything negative, to put out anything negative, to write or say or indicate in any way, anything negative against anybody else, especially when it's true. If it's not true, it's another whole problem. It's a different Aveira. But if you said something about somebody that was 100% true, absolutely accurate, that they really did, and you said it accurately, that's Aveira of Lashon Hara. You're not allowed to say that. Now, we'll discuss another time, Yitzhak Shem Lashon Hara. We have to give a whole share to what it means. But that's the Aveira of Lashon Hara. Lashon Hara is not saying bad things about people that aren't true. It's saying things about people that are 100% accurate, but that they wouldn't like said about them. Now, what happens is this. What have you done? You said something about somebody that was perfectly true. So now he's got the power to say against you what's true about you, and he says it. But if you never say against anybody anything bad at all, there's nothing he can say against you. Because he doesn't have the power to speak. You follow that? It's the most incredible piece of spiritual knowledge. By the way, if you want proof of this, you read what it says about Lashon Hara in all the mystical writings. It says the most amazing thing. It's worse than murder. It says it's worse than murder. It's worse than immorality. It's worse than it destroyed the best. It's the worst of error in the world. Why? Why? There's much worse things. I promise you, killing somebody is much, much worse than saying a bad word about somebody. Really, literally. So why does Chazal say? The reason is because the reason it's worse is because it opens the avenue of all the punishments in the world. Murder is much worse. But no matter what you did in the world, if you'd never said Lashon Hara, they can't bring it against you. It's an incredible secret. I don't know why you aren't jumping up and down with glee. Do you know what this means? Let me just finish the idea and I'll try and understand your question. You don't want to get around that. Now, don't get around it. Just accept it. It's fine. It's fine. Hold on, hold on. What? Let me just finish the idea. Hold on. No, no. Let me just... hold your question for a second. Remember it. So, in other words, what have we said? We said this, that he only has the power, which means a most amazing, amazing paradox in the spiritual world. That even though you deserve it, and you're in court already, and you haven't done tshuva, and you've got those things against you, they can never hold them against you, because the final common pathway of bringing that canon to bear is the Lashon Hara, which you've said about people, and you never said it, and of course if you said, you do tshuva. If you have said Lashon Hara, if you do, it's not easy to do tshuva, because you have to take back all the damage and all the negativity, but you have to try and do that. If you do it sincerely, you wipe it out. And from this moment on, you guard yourself. That you never even raise an eyebrow in acquiescence of anything negative about it. That's bad enough. That's also Lashon Hara. If somebody says, you know, such and such, and you go, yeah, that's bad enough. That's absolute Lashon Hara. You're not allowed. That's terrible. You can't do that. But if you guard yourself against all that, not even ambiguous statements against anybody, absolute cleanliness in that area, so you can never, they can never hold it against you. Yeah, let's just hear the questions, then we'll try. Sorry, there was a question first. What do you mean around it? You don't want to get it. Oh, how do you avoid Lashon Hara?
No, how do you avoid even listening?
Yeah, how do you avoid the Issa, the Avera of Lashon Hara? Okay, that's a long... Yeah, yeah. The Gemara says, you know why your fingers are shaped this way? Because they fit in your ears. You must say that. On the same page with the Gemara, it says that this soft part of your ear, the hard part of your ear is for reflecting sound, but this part doesn't reflect sound. The Gemara says it very neatly folds up and blocks the... And that's what you should do. You develop a stomach ache. Well, first of all, get right the trick of not speaking Lashon Hara about anybody else. That's the first trick. That's the first trick. Not to say anything or indicate anything. You have to train yourself very, very assiduously in that way. Not to hear Lashon Hara, which is also a big avera. You have to... There's a whole detailed study of it. We'll have to devote a whole session to it sometime. Meantime, in preparation for that session, read a book called Guard Your Tongue. There's a wonderful English book. It's a digest of the Chofetz Chaim's work on Lashon Hara. It's called Guard Your Tongue. It's a very simple English book with very practical examples. He actually brings cases and how you avoid the case and so forth. Subtleties that you wouldn't believe. It's a very, very detailed subject. If people want to, I'm happy to spend a whole session and we can talk. Maybe next week in session. I don't know, some other time. We'll talk about Lashon Hara in detail. But you have to avoid it. Don't forget, Hashem never holds against you something that you were incapable of. If you walk in and somebody blasts you with some aspect of Lashon Hara that you never intended, you never, you shouldn't, there was no reason, you shouldn't have been there, etc., etc., there's nothing you can do about it. So you leave as soon as possible. You inform your friends. Your friends will think you're nuts the first few times that you tell them. Eventually, I'll respect you for that principle. There's a whole discussion we have to have about how you go about avoiding that. But you have to do your best to do that. Yeah, one second.
It might sound stupid, but does Lashon Hara apply to non-Jews as well?
This deal, ask me privately.
You
I always answer you privately, though. Not in the same way, yeah. It also doesn't apply to Rishoyim. Somebody who's an accredited Rosha, you follow? Who needs to be somebody that you would be, let's say, that would definitely have like a death sentence against him for crimes against humanity. So it would be far. We just don't mention his name because it's just beneath us. But there's no problem with Lashon Hara there. You have to know where yes and where no. Also things that are generally known, if they're really widely known. There are some instances in which you may say it. Also, there are certain cases where it's for a definite positive benefit. You can tell a parent something about their child that's definite Lashon Hara, because the parent will then correct the child in that way. In fact, you have to. So it's a long study. But before you say something in Lashon Hara that's allowed, there are five requirements that have to be settled. It must be exactly true. You must know it firsthand. You may not exaggerate. It must only be for positivity. And it must be that you couldn't have achieved the same end any other way. Okay? But it's a long, long... Excuse me? Ask me privately. Yeah. Yeah. Yes. Absolutely not. Absolutely not. First of all, thoughts of sin, thoughts of avera, don't have the same category of averas at all. Okay? You have to know, there's sometimes when a thought of something wrong, Hashem considers it as if you did it, and sometimes, and a mitzvah also, if you tried and didn't do it, and sometimes not. That's another subject. Secondly, you are allowed to think negatively in order to protect yourself. You don't have to be a fool. If somebody did something negative, right? You don't have to. You're not allowed to bear a grudge. You're not allowed to take revenge. You're not allowed to say any Lashon Hara. But you're certainly allowed to remember it and bear a grudge in a protective sense. That means you're allowed. Let me give you an example. Let's say somebody did tell you something negative about someone that they shouldn't have. You're not allowed to believe it. The issue of Lashon Hara is if you listen to it and if you believe it. You may not believe it, but you may remember it
as a protection in case it's true. You're just not allowed to decide that they definitely did that thing. But you don't have to be a fool. Do you follow me? You don't pretend that it's not true and then marry your daughter to, or your child to that person or engage in business with them. You don't have to do that. Do you follow me? It's a very subtle issue. We'll have to discuss. Don't ask me practical challenges now about Lashon Hara. We'll have to. Yeah.
But my sister caught me.
You
mentioned the fact that you judged and you're opening yourself up if you talk Lashon Hara. You're talking about someone else.
Yeah.
But you're judging yourself. Why should you? You're standing up there and you're saying that the judges are yourself, looking at your own crimes.
Yes.
Why has it got anything to do with someone, a second party?
Because when you, first of all, this might make it easier for you. You're not allowed to say Lashon Hara against yourself either. You may not say anything negative about yourself, even if it's true. Unless it obeys all the rules you said before, that it's constructive and necessary and so forth and so on. So that applies against yourself also. But that's not the point here. The point is that when you put out accusatory power in the world, when you generate that in the world, so it's in the world and it'll come back on you. That's all. You follow me? It's exactly the same force. Think about it. Yeah.
If somebody does something wrong to you, and I'm reporting to you or to you or to whatever, is that not wrong?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Well, just let's never mind. Okay. Look, these are all practical questions in Lashon Hara. Let's just try to deal with it briefly. 1 second, please. 1 minute. The question was, what happens if somebody does something bad to you? Are you not allowed to say anything about it? So the thing is like this. You're only allowed to say anything about it to somebody if all the rules are observed. Namely, must be for a positive purpose. For example, that they can then do something about it. Like, for example, they were about to marry that person. And you just heard something that that person did that would be terrible if this person married them or set up a business with them or etc., 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 right? Lent them money or whatever. So then in that case, you're actually obliged to tell the person. But, you must know it firsthand, not secondhand. You must have witnessed it yourself. It must be exactingly true, not a detail out of place, more or less. Do you follow? Etc., etc. It must be that it will achieve the desired end, probably. There's no other way to do it, etc., etc. And your vested interest is not any pleasure at all, only to achieve that result. Now, if that happens, then you may or even have to say that. But if not, absolutely, cook inside. Absolutely. If you really want to know the spiritual effort, is that people shouldn't, you shouldn't be upset inside either. That's another mitzvah, that if somebody does something wrong to you, that you know about. Never mind what you're allowed to say to somebody else. There's another issue that you shouldn't feel anything negative. You should take pity on the person for having done a thing like that. And not feel the anger that you... That's another question. That's a question of feeling anger. But I feel something else in this question. Okay? And therefore, I'll just tell you one extra detail. If you go for therapeutic purpose to talk to somebody who might be able to help you with the situation, let's say you go and speak to somebody who's got some Das Torah, or it might even be in a medical therapeutic sense. You confide in this individual things that are definite Lashon Hara. But the reason you're doing it is because you're trying to get some practical help out of this person that may do it, so that allows it. But again, you've got to obey the same 5 careful rules that we said before. There is one question that I'm not able to answer, you'll have to ask someone who knows more than me, and that is that sometimes the benefit of saying Lashon Hara is just to relieve your own pain. But it's a definite therapeutic purpose. It's not going to change the person, but it's going to help you tremendously. That's a subtle halachic problem. At this point in time, I'm not able to answer. I just don't know enough. I'll try and research it, Lynette, and give you more feedback when we discuss Lashon Hara. I'm not clear about that. I'm in that problem, often medically, and psychiatrists and so forth are in that problem. There's many other problems also. It's a subtle area that has to be carefully worked out. I don't want to say now. I don't know enough about it yet. Sorry, somebody at the back of the question. I'm sorry? I don't hear you. I speak a lot of Lashon Hara. If a person does, yes? Yes? That you're still talking? The question is that... Listen, I'm further away than you. If a person's working on himself sincerely, and he reduces the level of Lashon Hara that he speaks... So, but theoretically he's not protected because he's still got some of that avar in his head, doesn't he? The answer is like this. It says, Hashem ena mekapeh schar kol beria, and that the Torah is not given into Malachim. That means if you do your sincere best in this area, it will never be held against you. What I suggest is apply for deferment of the trial on the grounds that you're working on silencing the prosecutor. You follow me? And they'll give you a deferment. And nothing's ever held against you unfairly. You follow me? If you're sincerely working on the root of the problem. By the way, it says that Baalei Lashon Hara have no share in the next world. That does not mean somebody who happened to speak Lashon Hara. It means somebody whose essence is Lashon Hara. That's his essence. That's what he does all the time. That's his idea of having a good time, is to gossip about other people. He has no share in the next world. It's one of the few categories of people who absolutely can't connect with Hashem at all. And it's also based on what we discussed tonight. We'll have to again, let's keep the questions, if you don't mind, to the issue of judgment and the mechanism of judgment, okay? It's going to be all Nazi and Lashon Hara, and we won't do justice to the subject. So if you've got questions on Lashon Hara, let's keep it as a separate subject. It has to be dealt with thoroughly, and Vinay will do that. Right now, let's just finish off the next few minutes with anything that relates to the judgment, and then I'll tell you the story. Yes. That's an excellent one. Yes. I don't follow you. If you didn't know about an Avera, if you did something wrong that you genuinely did not know was wrong, listen. I don't care if it's stated or not. If you didn't know it was wrong when you did it, it will never be held against you. Are you with me? If you didn't know it was wrong, unless you should have known. And you, it was in your power to know, and you didn't. The information was available, and you willfully negated the opportunity of going to learn about how to better yourself, etc., etc. That's a debate among the Rishonim, whether you are held fully accountable. You follow me? Because you should have got the knowledge, and others who say, well, but you didn't have. But the real answer to it is as follows. Only Hashem knows what, you follow, he won't judge you for transgressing wearing shatness if you never heard about it. You're not allowed to wear wool and linen mixed together. If you never heard about that, he can't possibly hold it against you. But if you should have gone to hear about it at some stage, it was a meaningful choice for you, and you rejected it, so then you'll be judged for that. You follow me? And if you really couldn't have, because you were brought up in an environment where you didn't have a chance, they won't hold it against you. But I promise you, that's the good news. The bad news is, they'll hold against you all the things that you did know about. Never mind what the Torah says, they'll hold against you things that you claimed were your values in life. You follow me? Let's say you never heard of any of the mitzvahs of the Torah, or you brought up in such a negative way, you really never considered them to be realistic at all. But you did believe in treating your friends correctly, right? You believed in tremendous loyalty and never letting a friend down, let's say, right? All the times that you let a friend down, they're going to hit you very hard with those things. Because those were your values. You follow me? They've got nothing to do with being Jewish over there. They always hold against you the things that you ascribe to in terms of your own values. You've got to be true to... Okay? Yes, please. I can't hear you. If you did what? Stop speaking Lashon Hara. Yes, it does say that in Chazal. But one of the reasons that you reward... But we didn't say there aren't other reasons you might die young. There's other reasons too. You understand? There's many, many factors that interplay in how long you'll live. But if you want to understand, the reason it says that a person who never speaks Lashon Hara will live a long and tranquil life, that's what it says. Long and peaceful. The reason is because they can never hit you with the accusations that try to bring the punishment and sufferings against you. You follow? That's the mechanism. They can't bring them to bear on you because you never put that force into the world. But unfortunately, there's many other spiritual forces operating. David HaMelech, you picked a bad example. He lived 70 years because he should never have lived at all. Adam HaRishon was supposed to live 1,000 years. And he gave 70 of his years that David should have a lifespan. So he lived on gifted, borrowed time the whole of his life. It's a special mystical area that. Now into the Lashon Hara. Yes, please. I didn't hear the question. Yeah, that's another whole discussion. Exactly. Yes, please. Yes. I understand your question. It says that if you did such negativity in the world, it doesn't have to be such negative, any negativity that tshuva can't affect. So how do you get out of that? That's your question. The Gemara talks about that case. It says if a man had a forbidden sexual relationship with a woman, and let's say she was married, and a child was born, she bore a child. So the child has got a spiritual stigma that he can never get rid of. Now the father does tshuva, but the child's still in the world with all the ripples of negativity, etc., etc., etc. So the mystics say like this, that you cannot take care of the negativity. But when they come to put it on you, if you've done effective tshuva, you're not the person who did it anymore. So the damage is in the world, but they can't put it on you. You change your address. You're no longer there. You so changed yourself that you would never do that thing if you were in the same position again. You so cleansed your own being. Do you follow me? So the only problem that remains now is there's damage in the world. Hashem takes care of the damage. There are even mystical statements that he actually takes care of the damage. If you merit it, he actually takes care of the damage for you. But you don't have to worry about that. Do you follow me? The Rambam, but let's just hold your question because we're coming in a chapter or two if we ever get there. where the Rambam will talk about 24 categories of things that you can't do tshuva for, or very, very hard to do tshuva for, and they will understand your question more deeply. There are 24 things that a person can do that he may never be given the chance to do tshuva for, never mind can't. Okay, we'll have to discuss that. Is there one more question, and then, because I don't want to keep people too late. Yes, please. Is it on the question of judgment? And the story, I promised. All right, I'll finish that. Yes, did you hear our talk about the four levels of reality? Did you hear it? I went through there the problem of Hashem having an agency and that being a deficiency in his own being and how we understand that. If you didn't hear it well, or maybe you'd missed that part, then you could get a recording of that shiur. It's called Miracle and Nature, I think they called it here, or they called it the Mask of Nature, I think. And in that shiur I went through the four levels of understanding Hashem's essence and the problem of what it means when he has an agency. However, in this case, it's not a problem at all. In this case, it's your agency, not his. In this case, we're talking about something you generate, not a deficiency of Hashem's at all. You generated this force of negativity in the world. It's your problem. The only thing is that he sets up a courtroom, if that's what you mean, where the judgment operates through channels that are bad for you. Okay? That is, you'll find answered in that shir over there. However, you have raised the point which I'll just mention very briefly. You should have asked me a good question. None of you, I'm not saying you didn't ask good questions, but one question that is a very good question that nobody thought of asking, which shows that you all need some time in yeshiva to learn how to ask good critical analytical questions. You see, the ladies always ask practical questions, that's for sure, how you go about handling certain things. But there's one theoretical question you should have asked me, and that is, how is it possible that you can have done so much negativity and you can so simply block it off in one area and never have to pay the price? Didn't that bother you?
Yeah.
So why didn't you ask it? Because you knew I'd answer it. No, it's fantastic. Okay. The answer is this, that actually you do have to pay. If you did negativity and they can't pin it on you in the courtroom because you, okay, you do have to pay for it, but, the difference is this, that Hashem chooses one of two ways to deal with you. Either he himself through Rahamim, as I mentioned, or he sets up the court procedure the way I mentioned before. If you generate the necessary mechanism, you go to court. If you don't, and the court can't hold it against you, he himself deals with you with his own essence of Rahamim, and it is much, much, much gentler and kinder. He distributes the punishment over a lengthy period of time. He puts it off for various reasons. Okay? There's a whole different what's called Hanoga. To understand this, we'll have to understand what are different pathways in the spiritual world altogether, but there is such a thing. You do have to pay for it, and the consequences are always expressed in the world. But it's a completely different pathway, and I promise you, it's vastly preferable to go that route. Yes? Yes?
Right. Therefore, that to me doesn't imply that Hashem is always loving kind.
I didn't say Hashem is always loving kind. I said that he is always loving. Aren't you what? More likely?
Aren't you more likely?
No. Whether you listen carefully, whether you'll receive his anger, whatever that means. Actually, that's also a kindness. But anyway, for now, whether you'll receive what you're calling his anger, okay, a judgmental position, or you'll receive a kindly dispensation from him, depends on the way you set up your life. It's only according to the way you set it up. I think we'll have to talk about this in great detail also. Let me tell you the story, because I promised, and then what I'd like to do is say to him for 2 minutes, okay? The story very briefly is this. For those who are still terrified, so there is good news. I beg the indulgence of those who heard it before, but it's worth sitting through for those who haven't. Very briefly, it's like this. There is a... want to understand the role of suffering in the world. You heard the story, didn't you? What? Good. So listen again, okay? It says this, that there was once a chassid who had a lot of troubles. You don't mind it again, huh? He had a lot of troubles, and so he went to his Rebbe. So the Rebbe, he told the Rebbe that he had so much trouble he didn't know how he could bear all the suffering that he had in life. So the Rebbe took out a white hanky and he waved it in front of his eyes and the chassid went to sleep. While he was sleeping, he had a dream. In his dream, he reached the end of his life and he passed on into the next world. In the next world, he came to a big set of gates. And as he went through the gates, he asked them, they told him that he had to go down a certain long road, and he asked them where that road leads, and they said, to your trial. Okay, now the story is more meaningful, right? So he started walking down this long, long, long road. You can imagine his emotions as he's walking down this long road, knowing that the end of the road is the courtroom where he's going to be on trial. as he's walking along the road, an enormous rumble, the earth starts to shake, if you could call it that up there, but whatever it is he's walking on starts to shake, and as he looks behind him, he sees a long line of trucks, enormous cartage trucks, they're coming down the road. So he stops the driver of the first truck and he says, "Where are you going?" So the driver says, "We're going to your trial." So he says, "What do you have in all those trucks?" So he says, "We've got all your avaris." So he looks at this endless line of trucks and he says to the driver, "Maybe you could give me a lift." So the driver says, "No, we've got no room in here." So he walks on down the road while these trucks pass him and they eventually rumble off into the distance. Now you can imagine how he's feeling at this stage. After the dust settles, a little high-pitched whine sounds in his ears and he turns around and a little white car is bumping along the road. I heard this story from a great mystic in Yerushalayim. I heard the story from an amazing Kabbalist in Yerushalayim. He couldn't stop laughing while he told me the story. Okay, very interesting man. Anyway, I'll tell you about it some other time. This little white car came bumping along the road. So he stopped the driver of the car and he said to him, "Where are you going?" So the driver said, "I'm going to your trial." So he said, "What have you got in that car?" So the driver said, "All your mitzvahs." So he said, "Well, at least maybe you could give me a ride." So the driver said, "Sure, there's plenty of room in here." So he climbs in the car, and on the back seat is a little white bundle that's wrapped up. That's what it is. So now I can imagine his emotions. So at the end of the road, he finally gets to the... And the courtroom consists of an enormous pair of scales. That's all it is. And on the one side of the scale, they throw the little white bundle. And on the other side of the scale, they start unloading the trucks with all his avaris. Huh? I don't know what you're laughing about. And as they're about to put the last of his avaris on that side of the scale, he hears another rumble in the distance, and he turns around, and another long line of trucks is coming in. And as that line of trucks arrives, he asks the driver in the front truck what they have in all those trucks. And the driver says to him, "All your tzoros, all the troubles that you ever experienced in life, we bring into your trial." And they start throwing all the tzoros onto the good side of the scale. And they start throwing them and throwing them and throwing them. They start piling up. And finally, when they get to the last piece of trouble in the last truck, they throw it onto the scale and the scale just balances exactly. And he shouts out, "Hashem, why didn't you give me any more tzoros?"